You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 6th of April 2013, right here on Monocle 24. The man behind a new magazine called Printed Pages, a veteran creative director with 12 successful launches under his belt, and more print picks for the discerning reader. The Binding Glue is drawing for issue 32 of The Stack. Also coming up over the next hour, we trade reading tips with Andy Cowles, former creative director who has spent 9 years at IPC, the UK's largest consumer magazine publisher.
I'm going to be talking about The New Yorker. I'm going to be talking about the latest issue of Harper's Bazaar. I'm going to be talking about the publishing phenomena that is What's on TV.
And we'll also meet Jonathan Foreman, the co-founder of the new Mumbai-based title, Indian Quarterly.
One of the things we wanted in the magazine was to have what we called a Bombay sensibility. That's because most magazines in India come out of Delhi. Delhi really has taken over in the last 10 years as a cultural as well as an economic centre.
All that and a chat with It's Nice That founder Will Hudson on edition 32 of The Stack. Hello and welcome to a sunny Midori house, at least for the moment, and our weekly review of all of the finer things in print here on Monocle 24. I'm Tyler Brulé. After a full 3 weeks on the road, it's been an intense week on the editorial floor as we've wrestled with our May issue to get it out the door. If you hear a few bumps or body slams creeping through your speakers over the next 55 minutes, that's because our editors are still trying to pin down those last few pesky pages. Anyway, lots to look forward to in our special design directory that will be out in about 16 days' time, including an excellent bit of reportage off the coast of Newfoundland. Anyway, enough about us. Here's who's joined us around the table in Studio One today. Now, you might recognize the first voice, somewhat familiar here at The Stack, Will Hudson, of course, of It's Nice That fame. I can say fame, can't I? They think that you've got quite a following.
Not many people do.
Well, no. Anyway, no, last time we were talking about you had your annual, but also there's one particular little red-covered magazine, which has really been doing the rounds all through the building. And I have to say, great uptake on the Monocle editorial floor, but also on the floor of our design agency. Wink Creative as well, and that's Printed Pages. So what type of offshoot is this, and why?
Printed Pages is our new quarterly magazine, and the big kind of answer to the why question is we were printing a £10 magazine that we'd started 2 years after we started the blog, and I guess that had kind of gradually evolved, but we'd never really taken the time back to step back and go, right, what are we doing? And when we did that, we identified that we were doing something maybe very similar to a few other titles. We were an independent publisher trying to put a magazine out for about the £10 price mark. So we were immediately kind of competing with a whole host of other magazines. And we looked at it and kind of said, actually, there's an opportunity here to do something a little bit cheaper, so more accessible. But with that, more accessible in the way that we present the content, the way we manage that content, we've still got quite a small editorial team. And in order to maintain kind of 9-10 articles online every day alongside doing a quarterly, it just, we've got something now that feels very manageable. But the response has been fantastic, which is a big sigh of relief when working on something for kind of 6 months.
You've referenced price now three times. why did you feel that a point of accessibility is important? Because I think when we look at titles of this scale, I mean, oftentimes people don't really think about a barrier for entry in a way, because, you know, for a variety of reasons. I mean, from the publisher side, these are not inexpensive to do. And it seems, you know, as we've been doing this program for, you know, enough weeks now, that that also, you know, consumers, you know, will indulge in something where they feel there's real passion. And certainly you see that in your product. So, yeah, and I do have to say, so we're looking at a £4, you know, cover price. So, you know, a drop of £6 from what you're normally doing. Why? Why?
The funny thing is that immediately the kind of the first stage is the actual print production. As soon as we're doing something for £10, that kind of has to be reflected in the production of not just the physical thing, but the commissioning of photography, illustration, that kind of thing. But the things that we didn't really realise until the last couple of weeks is that that just the price thing comes all the way down. So we're now producing something that's lighter, so it's easier to package, it's cheaper to ship and get out to places. Both individual online orders, but also they're arriving in boxes. You get 40 to a box now instead of 20, 25. So to get out to, we've just shipped out to Tokyo, we shipped out to Australia, and it's everything is now just that much more manageable. And it's the top line risk, what we were investing in the magazine before, it's a fraction of that now. And it means that we can get excited again about...
Doesn't feel like it, though.
Well,
dear listener.
Well, we tried to maintain production values, but obviously on a kind of a 40% of maybe what we were doing before.
Okay, he's completely underselling it. Anyway, also joined around the table today by Andy Kells. Andy is an award-winning editorial and creative director at IPC Media and has worked on titles like Rolling Stone and Mademoiselle on the other side of the Atlantic. I was saying a little before we went on air, former creative director at IPC, still there for a stretch. I guess you've got another 3 weeks to run. And you know, for those people listening, maybe in other parts of the world right now, Andy, it's been, you know, there's been so much of attention and focus. And we've been talking over these last few weeks. Amazing to see this company also where I worked once upon a time. You know, Time Warner going from AOL, Time Warner, the power of Time Inc., and then you know, amazingly this business being hived off. You know, in London, this is also a publisher of scale. You know, IPC being a division of that. I don't want to maybe get into things that you can or can't talk about, but, you know, is there a question mark? It seems you look at media pages, people don't quite know what's happening. And is there a sense of I guess, indecision still there as well on the editorial floor?
I think what we're looking at here is the challenge faced by any publisher of scale. Time Warner is the biggest media company in the world. Time Inc. is their magazine publishing division. And IPC Media is the... It dukes it out with Bauer as to whether it's the biggest consumer publisher in the UK. It's pretty big. It's a publisher of scale. And I think the challenge that any publisher of scale has is how to respond to the speed of changes that are occurring in people's behaviours, the way the economy is, the way in which we choose to consume content. I think that, IPC, there's always been rumours about, oh, IPC is going to be sold, it's going to be broken, you can buy anything from IPC. Well, that's probably true, actually. If you've got the funds, you can probably walk across the road now and take your pick. But these are still very valuable brands. It's still a very valuable business. Time Inc. has four of the top 10 selling magazines in America.
Yeah.
Its market cap, when it's going to be floated on Wall Street, will be much greater than Meredith, which was the intended suitor.
Yes.
You could get into a situation where if Time Inc.'s market cap is made right and their debt isn't too big, well, they could buy Meredith.
Yes.
All sorts of weird shit could happen.
Well, and this is the amazing thing, you know, for anyone who maybe wouldn't get as far as, you know, paragraph 3 or 4 when the story is reported, the way the market builds this up, the way media commentators build it up, because you're talking about a paper in the business of you know, pulping trees and buying ink, is that the whole thing is a basket case. But, you know, I haven't looked at the, you know, the numbers, but, you know, what is it returning? Probably, you know, real profit, about $500 million a year. I mean, this is something which is not broken. Now, we don't know, of course, you know, what the roadmap looks like, but, you know, compared to some of the punts that you could take on other digital properties, things like that, it's still a sure bet for, it's a considerable stretch ahead of it.
I think what's happening, it's like the property market. Some parts of this business are still incredibly profitable. I mean, I'm bringing in one magazine here that I want to talk about, which just makes millions, you know, truly an awful lot of money. And it's operating in a market which has seen a 5% growth since the latest launch into that market.
Right.
But other sectors, like the Celebrity News Weekly market, because of people's behaviour and the way in which you can follow Rihanna on Twitter. Do you need that copy of Heat magazine? Mm. Possibly not. So I think that, you know, some sectors are seeing massive decline. Other sectors, considerable strength. Mm. You know, high-end specialist titles, fashion magazines, niche titles, or magazines that have a true purpose and real service and utility behind them. Brands with trust.
Well, are you sitting there thinking, thank goodness I'm not part of a corporate world, or you've certainly sort of carved a nice niche out so far. But I mean, you know, obviously you grew up with titles from IPC and many of the other big brands that we're talking about, and I'm sure they're probably part of your diet sometimes as well. When you look at these big companies, do you think that perhaps there's just too much of a fear factor, an unwarranted fear, maybe on the part of board members on editorial floors, etc. When, you know, as we're saying, you know, there are a lot of titles which still make money, and people, of course, like to assign, you know, potential valuations to other new media properties, you know, not knowing if they ever have a chance of turning a profit.
Yeah, potentially. I think the thing that I always think about when looking at these kind of big publishing houses is because they work all under one company, you can allow the opportunity to try stuff and kind of, I think issues can have a bit of a blip and they can then recover. The big difference with us being an independent publishing company with one title is if we have one magazine that no one wants to advertise in or no one wants to buy, it can have severe effects and it could end us pretty quickly. Mm. So it's partly that risk management. I wasn't aware that the kind of profit of these companies is as high as it is. And actually, if something is, I don't know, it's a funny one, isn't it? If you're making that much money, just crack on. Just
well, exactly. And I almost wonder, you know, whether this is, I've come to my own conclusions, whether this is a little bit of an Anglo-Saxon thing as well, that this sense of panic and, over the last few weeks, the show's been on the road elsewhere. You don't feel this in Germany right now. Newspapers are scratching their heads and publishing companies are wondering what's going on. But that idea that there should be suddenly a fire sale on, you know, on Madison Avenue, etc. This seems very much of a U.S. and a slight, and you feel it here, not so much in other corners of the world. And, you know, people are saying, you know, not just because they don't want to pay attention to Wall Street because they have to worry about Frankfurt or they have to worry about the cops in Seoul, but it's, yeah, I don't know what your view is, you know, coming from a company which is, you know, which is U.S. owned, and and let's see whose hands it ends up in.
I don't think it's a case of panic, but I do think that the executives in this business are looking at their own behaviours. You know, I read a tremendous amount on my phone, for example. I buy fewer magazines than I used to. So I don't think that it's a fire sale, but I do think that in the English-speaking world, you know, the uptake of tablets and the way in which we use the internet is very different to how it is in Germany. I mean, we were discussing this, Will and I, before we came on air about Bauer's point of view, for example, to their digital propositions, which seems a lot more relaxed and a lot less stressed, perhaps, than some other executives. And I think that may be because the internet is an English language experience to some extent. Maybe in Germany, they just don't do that to the same level of intensity. I'm not German. I don't know.
I'm sure there's going to be a number of letters inbound at the moment from listeners in Germany saying, we have the internet. It's arrived on that side of the channel. No, but I think also there's very different strategies. And Bauer's an interesting company, isn't it? Because here they're at a time when a lot of people thought, well, what's going to happen to, we were in Australia recently, what's going to happen to Australian Consolidated Press? Well, guess what's going to happen, ladies and gentlemen? It's going to be called Bauer. That's what's going to happen. And there they wade into the market and go and, buy up, a number of, very respected titles. I want to come back to tablets. We talked about it a little bit just a few weeks ago, I think, when we saw the latest round of ABC figures come out for a lot of magazines. And again, on this side of the Atlantic versus the United States, the uptake is not as big as many would have us believe. But I think that's another discussion for a little later on. I want to talk about the career of Andy Calzo for a moment. So in a few weeks, you leave this big organization, well-funded, et cetera, but obviously one, which we everyone in this market have seen that there are cutbacks and redundancies and all kinds of things going on. And then this big question of ownership, what happens? When you listen to Will and where he is, and probably, out the front door of your building and just seeing just the boom in new self-publishing models, et cetera, in this market, are you excited when you look at the state of where things have actually ended up, almost in counter to, I think, a lot of what's happened with the big corporations right now?
Without a doubt. Magazine publishing is all about being in the moment. It's about right now and the opportunity now to publish your content, whatever, however you want to do, is amazing. I publish my own content. I have my blog, I tweet, a few people look at it. I'm so excited by that. I really am. And I love the fact that I can, I can have access to content from all sorts of places and all sorts of people that I never had before. Mm. And it doesn't matter whether it's in print and it doesn't matter whether it's on a tablet or it doesn't matter whether it's a website or wherever it's from. I love the democratization of that. Mm. It's much like when they invented desktop publishing. Suddenly, we weren't, we weren't being run by the printers anymore.
Right.
We do it ourselves. And so, of course, it's incredibly exciting. And, the opportunities that will lie in front of me, I'm really interested in.
I have to ask Will. He says, I know you're talking about in really sort of broad brushstrokes, and he says it doesn't maybe matter that it's in print, but I wonder where we are, in so many markets, and having just done this tour through the continent and looked at what's happening, in so many places, particularly in Berlin, London as well. It doesn't matter that you're in print, though, because, you know, I think so much of what we've seen, you know, the launch of so many self-published titles, you started life as a blog.
Yeah.
And suddenly that, I know, you know, let's call it legitimacy or what people want, but...
There's something about the magazine that kind of validates who we are and what we do. And I don't know why that is. We know of a number of online websites, blogs that have huge respect, but... Even if it's us talking to potential advertisers or people that we want to work with or people that we want to interview, as soon as it's in print or as soon as we have that thing to put in front of people, whether or not it's because there's still this mindset that blogs can be run out of bedrooms and kind of we don't get dressed and we just sit there all day and kind of just regurgitate stuff, which isn't true. As soon as you do a magazine...
Such an ugly picture, that.
Thank you.
Proud of you. I'm saying it in general.
But the magazine is this thing that, I don't know, just the reaction you get when you hand it over to someone in it. And I think there's just that they look at you ever so slightly differently.
Mm. And as... Well, and, but, you know, and again, you know, we can look at... just watching, like, CNN last night, you know, they were... And, of course, much excitement because everyone in the graphics department gets to, look at all of their 3D modeling to figure out, you know, what could happen to Pyongyang. And suddenly they've got these massive sort of, you know, tables that look like, you know, iPads on steroids, but, you know, they're just computer generated, et cetera. So, you know, all of this excitement about digital, and yet you would have thought that, you know, generationally or half a generation maybe, we would have moved on from that. And is it just, still is it, are we hardwired in a way maybe that having paper, having this, the sense of the tactile, maybe even faster, you know, reference and recall on paper than you would have digital? Big question, but why do you think it is?
A short answer might be. I think the quick accessible stuff, I think, will be digital. And when you want to know the latest news story, you'll go online, you'll do those things. For me, the kind of the place that print still fits into my life is when I want to take a step back from that. I'll never read a magazine kind of at my desk.
Mm.
I'll always take a minute to go and sit down somewhere else and kind of leaf through. And it's, I think, in maybe in a world that we spend so much time in front of these devices, print still allows that thing to kind of step back. And you know that it's not yesterday. It's, you're looking at something that kind of has had a bit of time spent on it and not more consideration, because there's still a huge amount of consideration that goes into all the content we produce online. But I think it's maybe just that mindset that you can detach yourself from that. And actually, one of the worst things about when we come on to talk about tablets is you're reading something, but you've got a Twitter
feed. We've already done that. We're not going back to talk about them anymore.
That's then reminding you and taking you away from that content. And a magazine doesn't have those distractions.
I think this is about identity. I think that print defines you in the real world. Whether you are interested in Dagenham Dog Breeder Monthly or a copy of Vogue. I mean, you had a very strong opinion about me if you saw me carrying that magazine around, for example, a fine title. I think it's about who we want to be, about who we aspire to be. And when you're in the company of print product, you are part of that. Magazine brands are like cults, very elite clubs, but the price of admission is very low. And I can join these cults. I can join these elite clubs for a few pence or a few pounds. And when you're in physically with the magazine, you're immersed in that world. And I think that's incredibly seductive and incredibly powerful. It allows you to describe who you are to yourself and to others around you in the real world. Now, obviously, we have our virtual worlds now, and we are defined by what we share and about what we comment on and how we operate between our peers and our social networks and everything else. And that's all fine, and that's real too.
Mm.
But it's not the whole wheel.
Do you think that the discussion has moved, you know, perhaps too much to the latter, Andy? And I'm wondering whether, you know, whether it's an IPC or whether it's, you know, at Bauer or any number of other big publishing companies around the world, are people still looking at the value of that cult where I don't have to be linked into any social network at all? I just see you walking down the street with that magazine, and I have an opinion of you. I either want to go up and talk to you about your Wheaton Terriers because you've got that magazine, or what you happen to think about that celebrity on the cover of that fashion title.
It's all about that. Yes, if I'm walking down the street with a copy of Elle and I've got Rihanna on the front cover, and she is, or at least the last issue, that says something about me. It says about my world view, if you like, as seen through that facet, that prism.
Mm.
If I come in here with a copy of The Guardian, I'm a Guardian reader. This is about brands, brand power. If I come in here with a copy of The Sun, I'm a Sun reader. I'm going to feel different about myself.
But do you think that? But is that discussion still happening in companies, though? That's what I'm driving at. Is because everyone is digital, digital, digital. Are they still saying there is a value in Rihanna being on the cover and also what goes into the print edition as opposed to just are we going to cut the trim size?
Well, without shadow of a doubt, an awful lot of these big publishing companies, their profit is still largely out of print. And the challenge for a big publishing company is to manage that in order to be able to produce the revenue for the growth, because it's print for profit and digital for growth.
Absolutely.
And that's how the business is. So for sure, print is a really, really important part of this business and will continue to be so. Less so in some markets, but in other markets, go and talk to the editor of Country Life magazine and you'll have you'll be looking at a very happy man.
On that note, we are going to go away for a very short break. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. When we come back in a moment, we're going to be looking at the launch of a new title out of India, the Indie Quarterly.
Taiwan's southern port of Kaohsiung is the topic of our latest Monocle film. Once a neglected sibling to Taipei, we visit a city attempting to balance industry with livability.
Kaohsiung is most intriguing in that it's no post-industrial town searching for a new reason to be. Rather than move beyond its industrial roots, Kaohsiung is aiming to show that it can sculpt a city that people want to live in without sacrificing its role as the industrial heart of Taiwan.
Taiwan, turning the tide, on Monocle.com.
If we use, dear listeners, the metaphor of Monocle 24 as an online radio amusement park, then Culture with me, Robert Bound, is the roller coaster.
We are finally on the train, on the sexy contemporary art train.
Scaling the heights of artistic endeavour to look out across a picturesque international landscape dotted with galleries, live music venues, outdoor screenings of wonderful movies being scrutinised and applauded by appreciative audiences. Marvel at the view. Strap yourself in. Scream, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to go faster. We're just one metaphor away from a meltdown. On the latest edition, we dress up as the next Harry Potter to attend Bologna's Children's Book Fair, go largely AWOL at a festival in Mexico, and find out why there's a big red shed on London's South Bank.
It has been, I think, a real bolt of energy and excitement throughout the whole of the organisation, the fact that we've got this temporary chance just to sort of let collective hair down a little and do something different.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24. I hope it's still sunny here in London. We're with you for another 34 minutes. Of course, the news is always at the top of the hour here on this very stage. We're talking to Andy Coles of IPC. And of course, Will Hudson, who's been a very familiar voice around here. And of course, we have very early on, if you missed it, he was talking about the new launch of the very tactile printed pages. Now, another title that we want to look at is a little something out of India. Because when you look at the figures that show the state of print around the world, India always represents one of the biggest growth regions. London-based editor Jonathan Foreman is hoping to make the most of this burgeoning market with a new literary and cultural magazine called The Indian Quarterly. Our Tom Edwards spoke recently with Jonathan about the rivalry between the Mumbai and Delhi publishing scenes.
One of the things we wanted in the magazine was to have what we called a Bombay sensibility. That's because most magazines in India and most publications that come out of Delhi. I mean, there are a few in other places, but Delhi really has taken over in the last 10 years as a cultural as well as an economic center, as well as, of course, a place of government. I mean, there were wonderful magazines in Bombay in the 1970s and even into the 80s, and then they sort of disappeared for a variety of reasons, including a more hostile political climate and the movement of money to New Delhi. And, there have been some very good new publications in Delhi in the last few years. Caravan is a very good monthly. There's a magazine called Open, which is terrific, and which is a weekly. So, but it's all been happening in Delhi. And we thought there are so many creative people in Bombay. The majority of India's most interesting writers are either from there or living there, including the people who edit the magazines in Delhi. And we just thought there's room for this here. And there's still such a flourishing art scene there. India's best artists all live in Bombay, that this is the place we want to do it. And so we wanted it to be a bit like the New Yorker, in the sense that the New Yorker has articles about all sorts of places, about America and abroad, but has a sort of New York sensibility. I mean, that's what we wanted to do with Indian Quarterly.
Now, you've certainly got the culture there, as you say, that surrounds it. There's so much vibrancy in that scene. But were there problems, or are there problems, when you come to tackle a creative project like this? As you said, you've mentioned it can be a fairly prohibitive regulation, this kind of thing. Is that a problem?
There are political sensitivities you have to be very careful of, and that can even come affect whether you call Bombay Mumbai or Bombay. In our historical pieces, of course, we always referred to, if it was referring to something before the city was renamed, it was very easy to call it Bombay. But most of our writers still use the term Bombay. That could provoke an organization like the Shiv Sena, which is the Marathi nationalist political party in Bombay, which gets very upset by that kind of thing. And they're the people who renamed the airport and the train station and the city itself. There is that. There's also still a residual thing in India about presenting India in the best possible light. You're much less likely to find in a magazine like this anything that might be deemed critical of India. You know, there are some very good political magazines like Tehelka, but you know, the idea that people said, oh, we don't want another magazine that goes on about poverty and things. And, you know, well, it's quite difficult to write about India without talking about the crises that exist. We're supposed to be a thought-provoking magazine. There's nothing really political in there at all. And that made things much, much easier. That said, there were some, you know, even our publishers were at first nervous about, we have an article in there about the 1962 war between India and China, which India lost. And they were very nervous about that. Even though it was 50 years ago and there's no one around now who could be hurt by that. But they just felt a bit funny about that, talking about something that wasn't positive, partly because people in India have become used to English language coverage, especially where foreigners are involved, that's unremittingly positive and about how wonderful everything is and how the changes are all great and how terrific it is and how everyone's getting richer and life just gets better and better and better. And of course, that isn't actually true.
And talk to me a little bit about the bigger picture then. We've mentioned there's a dynamic between New Delhi and Mumbai about, you know, where the real creative hub might be, and this magazine perhaps sort of in the vanguard in some way of kind of maintaining and reasserting, you know, Mumbai's claims to being a, you know, the really important cultural center. Do you feel there are things you're doing which are sort of daring? Are you encouraged to sort of take a few risks, maybe make some statements? Is that part of it, or is it more about?
Well, I think it does implicitly. You're right. Implicitly, it does, because we do have these foreigners writing in here and writing, some of them are not foreigners, not necessarily writing about India, although some are. That's interesting because, and that's part of the Bombayness of it, in the sense that because Bombay, Mumbai, it's the most outward looking city in India historically and still is today. And it's where a lot of people who've gone to universities abroad come back to work. It's the most cosmopolitan city in India. And Delhi is much more cosmopolitan than it was, but it's still not Bombay. It has other advantages over Bombay. It has more and better bookshops and things. But Bombay's still the place where it's where India faces the world from. And it's where trends come from the outside world to India first and become established very, very quickly now, and with amazing speed. And so that is part of the sensibility we were trying to capture. And by having a significant number of foreigners writing for it, more than any other Indian publication, that in itself is a kind of statement. And it wouldn't have been possible a few years ago because people would have felt, you know, colonized. They would have felt, certainly people would have not liked it. And that's very, I mean, the fact that this is a magazine with a foreign co-editor, myself, I mean, that is kind of a daring thing. And that's to the credit of the publisher, who's Anuradha Mahindra. I mean, it's a rare thing, but of course she's part of a family that comes from a company that produces cars that get sold around the world. So it is the new global Indian business person who's behind the magazine. And it's sort of written for people who are global, for sort of global Indians, people who are culturally global.
It sounds like you're in the right place. It sounds like a very exciting time. I just wondered then, looking ahead, the future issues in planning, close to going to print, and what might some of these themes be? Will they be other of these big swirling issues, or what are some of the kind of ideas you've had already?
The second issue has as a subtitle, you know, we copied Granter's, you know, thematic titles. You know, we've been pretty ruthless about copying things. And it's the second one is crossings. It's all about, you know, people crossing borders internally or externally or psychologically. And I'm not sure what the issue three will be yet. And it's, but it's had a good reception so far. And people have liked the idea of having these relatively long articles. Although, of course, not as long as we originally planned. Funny, as an editor, you suddenly realize after you've read your 5,000 words, you think, you know, that really is enough. And I think, no, it just, Maybe nowadays no one can actually put up with things that are super long. But it's, and we just hope it's going to keep on going. It, you know, it depends on all sorts of things. Economically, things aren't quite as good as they were last year in India. So it's, you know, if you are going to have a publication that's going to be on really beautiful, quite heavy paper and with really good illustrations, there's a bit of an economic gamble in that. So we've got to hope that the advertising follows it. And, you know, that's what we'll see. It is a gamble. People have liked it very, very much. The other thing is we want it to get to other cities outside Bombay, because there are these cultural worlds all around India, and you can be a big hit in the sort of cultural ghetto of Bombay without considered important there, without necessarily everyone ever reading you even in a big city like Bangalore, but certainly in some of the smaller cities. And yet all of those cities have their little cultural scenes, but nothing unites them. So it would be read in all those places. And ideally, I'd love to have some translations from some of the other local languages. You know, and this is very much obviously addressed at English-speaking India, which is a nation in itself and quite a large one. But it's we'd like to be able to include that. One of the things we were thinking of doing, we were talking to a man who was a retired member of the Indian Civil Service or Indian Administrative Service, who said, it would be a great thing to send out to all the district commissioners, because, of course, India still has district commissioners like it did during the British Raj, and it's often a government official who's sent out to an incredibly remote place. And, you know, for someone like that, even though they probably do get the internet now, it's kind of a great idea to get a big, you know, a chunky magazine that's got, you know, 100 and, in this case, 190 pages of quite dense reading, perfect for someone like that. And, you know, it's quite possible that in India, you do often find yourself sitting somewhere wanting something to read. And print is still a growing medium. And, you know, that's the other thing people tend to forget. I mean, more newspapers and magazines are being launched there, and newspaper circulations are growing. As more people become literate and join the middle class, more people have a stake in society and want to read. And so it's very exciting to be in a world where you don't feel like it's all shrinking.
Yes, you must be excited also listening to that if you're a German or Japanese newspaper pressmaker as well. That was our Tom Edwards talking to Jonathan Foreman, the editor of the Mumbai-based The Indian Quarterly. Andy, in that piece, we heard Mr. Foreman talking about, you know, the ambition for this to be something along the lines of The New Yorker. Now, of course, they'll have to up their frequency because The New Yorker is certainly not a quarterly. But that aside, I was just looking at one story, and they've got this piece, Walking Manto's Bombay. And there's, you know, a nice bit of photojournalism. It says if there was ever a bard of Bombay, it was Manto, the subcontinent's greatest writer of short stories. Earlier this year, the anniversary of Manto's birth, the photographer Ram Raman visited the neighborhoods where Manto and his friends lived, worked, and played. It could almost be a Stanfirst out of The New Yorker, potentially. I'm wondering, what did you make of the title at first glance while we were listening to that piece?
Well, I admire the ambition, without a doubt. I think there are many clues in the cover as to what kind of piece of business this is. It's also got a spine as well. And the spine makes it feel rather daunting to me. They've thought, ooh, there's quite a lot in here. I think they're very timid around the size of the word, The Indian Quarterly. I cannot read that. And there are legibility issues around that queue, because that queue is a text queue, not a real queue. But I love the painting. I think, and that is the thing that gives me a sense that I'm looking into new worlds and have new ideas here, which I might otherwise never encounter. They list an awful lot of writers, which tells me there's an awful lot of writing in it.
good global shorthand for a cover, isn't it?
Yeah.
To me, when I look at it, reminds me of a magazine which I like very much, which is Cornucopia, which, you know, is also very narrow in its view and covers the world of Turkey and, let's say, the former Ottoman Empire as well. Quite indulgent, big family who's backing this magazine as well. But when you look at, you know, emerging markets, and I'm sort of, you know, wondering, as you scout around the world, you know, is there a part of you as well thinking, actually, it's really interesting right now when you hear about the fact that they're turning on presses, you know, maybe I should go to India, where you, and particularly when, you know, that sort of thing was the fascinating things you're saying earlier, Andy, but when people are identifying themselves with brands, you know, we can look at, you know, Myanmar, we can look at Brazil, we can look at all sorts of economies, which are going to go through what's only been happening in our markets, I'd say, you know, 2 decades ago.
Absolutely right. I mean, my wife and I talk about this all the time. She's constantly telling me, she's saying, you're going to end up in Mumbai at this rate, because this is where business is to be done. These markets are incredibly exciting, no question about it. And of course, I would love to work in these places. I've worked I've worked in Australia, I've lived there, I've worked in New York City, I've lived there. Mm. The idea of being able to take what I know and turn that into any market in the world, whatever the language, would be amazing. And I would truly welcome that opportunity should it arise. People are people. Mm. Stories are stories.
Now, at the top of the show, you mentioned The New Yorker, and of course, Mr. Foreman, you know, talked about his ambitions to do something along The New Yorker lines with this. Why did you, we'll look at, you've got a variety of titles that we're going to talk about today, but let's start with The New Yorker, and of course, it is a magazine that comes up again and again, and if I, you know, peer into the tops of people's tote bags in this building as well, it's amazing, you know, how many people have their copies of New Yorker, but you could actually peel open everyone's bag in the building and maybe you'd find 15 people who have The New Yorker, but I bet you not one of them is reading the same issue. You've got someone who's got one 6 weeks ago, someone went down and has, you know, this week's edition, and it's remarkable. Why have you chosen The New Yorker today?
Well, as you say, many people can choose this. You know, it is one of the greatest magazines in the world, no question about that. It's weekly, and so therefore it's paradoxical because it feels really urgent and really quick because it's so slim and so easily accessible.
Well, I want to go back to the point actually just while you're talking about slim and accessible, and you talked about a perfect bound magazine like the Indian Quarterly, and you said because it has a spine, there's something quite daunting about it. And so when you see something which is saddle stitch, is that, again, is that just shorthand for urgent, quick?
Yeah. A spine says, refer to me. It says, look at me. You put it on a shelf like a book. And so therefore, it's not of the moment. Whereas this has no spine. I mean, it has a faux spine. They put the black strip down the side. But that's because they just need to end the image because they don't want the image to be ended by the printing process. They want it to end decisively. But it is an extraordinary piece of work. I mean, I think that New York is an amazing city. It's so cosmopolitan, so multicultural. And I think even if you've never lived there, you've seen it in all the movies. I think that it's possible for anyone to think that they are a New Yorker, spiritually, to some extent. So I regard this as a magazine about humanity. The thing I love about it is its commitment to art in every form. It's very rare that you will find an image in the company of another. The context of this is quality writing. So when you see an image, it may not be very large, but it will be held within a page of text. There's a fine example. It's a beautiful illustration. It's not large. If there were other images on this page, it would be crushed. But here it's just held in amazing writing. And the commitment to the quality of the writing is such, and the trust in the brand is such that, you know, I subscribe to this magazine. I maybe read, I don't know, 5 or 10% of it, like most people of magazines that they buy. But when I open the pages of it, I'm willing to engage with content that I'm not searching for because I trust this brand. I know that if I'm going to read something on North Korea, gay rights, American politics, rock and roll, whatever it is, it's going to be peerless. And I feel good when I'm in the company of this brand. I think I'm a New Yorker. I'm a New Yorker reader. How great is that?
And yet, there's been this huge discussion right now about the death of the International Herald Tribune title, and everyone's saying, oh, you know, is the New York Times group crazy to be killing this off because we're going to have this international edition of the New York Times? You know, will anybody, you know, connect with it because it's place mark or, you know, it's date stamped as New York, and, you know, how can you build a brand in Singapore, etc. And so, you know, there's been so much, you know, talk about this, and, you know, I guess we'll see when the IHT name sort of officially disappears. But yet, you know, it has The New Yorker is a very good example, you know, for all of those naysayers, of a title that, you know, can do international journalism, can be anywhere, can be on the front lines in Afghanistan, and it absolutely doesn't matter a jot where it's edited or what the masthead says.
I think the International Herald Tribune is a terrible title. That's really clumsy. I have no idea what that means or what that stands for. It feels like a bit of a business title. Whereas the New Yorker is an expression of life and vitality. And it's who I am. It's who we all are if we consider ourselves part of the world.
Will, are you a New Yorker?
No. No, I'm not. But it is one that we've referenced time and time again when we were looking at producing the new magazine, because I think it that whole kind of content is king.
You saw the staples, you thought, I need some of those?
Well, no, but everything Andy's just kind of said has kind of made me think, actually, I want that to live on a shelf and I want that to do those things. But what we said was that whole content is king. And the New Yorker, the design doesn't change that much. Mm. I love the illustrated cover every time. I think that's something that does make it stand apart from a very kind of face value point of view. But it's the content thing. As long as you get the content right, people will trust it. They'll keep coming back. They'll talk about it. They'll read it. And that's what we have to maintain within printed pages is great content. Mm. Because we know people will pick up a copy for the design, but they won't keep picking up a copy for the design. The content is what will keep people coming back, talking about it. And that's why The New Yorker, I think, is such a great title.
Yeah, and again, you have a Chris Ware piece in this issue, and looking at how he's able to create these adult comic books and these visual narratives, which is great, and you've done a wonderful celebration of that. And it's and again, this is also you can look at the pretty pictures, but I think and is as you were citing as well, just the way that they're able to sort of take quite a dense body of text, but just place that sort of little pithy cartoon. There's so much craft in that, and it's no mean feat to also go and commission these types of things, whether it is getting that cover on point and also politically on point, which is always, I think, amazing about The New Yorker.
The other thing is worth making the comment, although there is an awful lot to read in here and pages of text, it's not hard to read. They've set it in 10 point. It's set in 10 on 12 across the correct measure in the right font. The legibility of this is really high. Even when the pages are read in the shower or in dim light, you with tired eyes, and a lot of the readers of The New Yorker perhaps will be a little bit older. Mm. We're not 18-year-olds, so I find it incredibly easy to read and very relaxing as a result of that. So I think the attention to detail typographically, the discipline with way in which they manage the setting is really quite outstanding. It's textbook stuff.
Yeah. And, why don't we bring it back to a tablet discussion in a moment, but of course there's a lot of print sitting on the table too. We're going to go away for a very short break. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We're back in a moment.
The beautifully turned out April issue of Monocle includes our new spring style directory, which takes a look at the best retail projects around the globe, the new shopping neighbourhoods, why Jakarta is on the fashion map, and how the Swiss make the watch world tick. We also take a visit to Tokyo Hands, the famous Japanese store where you can buy everything you didn't know you needed. And we have lots more in this issue too.
In the affairs section, we head to the Turkey-Syria border to discover what NATO is and isn't doing in Syria. We visit the largest Finnish community outside the Nordic region. It's in Canada. And we also meet a woman you might remember, Imelda Marcos, and her shoe collection.
In the business section, we take a sniff at the scent industry. We send our Paris correspondent south to Grasse to find out how the Provençal town is becoming a hub for high-tech innovation. And we introduce a new section, Master and Apprentice. In the first instalment, we profile a man who started tailoring aged 11.
In culture, we ask how you renovate and rebrand one of the world's greatest museums. We visit Amsterdam's Istanbul Rijksmuseum to see what a 10-year sabbatical teaches you. We also investigate high turnover tales in the world of the art postcard, and just for a minute, give in to the allure of the average, courtesy of our Culture Ed's column.
The April issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or treat yourself to a subscription. Visit monocle.com now to find out how to join the club.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24, talking to Will Hudson, also Andy Cowles. Just during the break, gentlemen, and we were referencing off the back of this discussion about The New Yorker, and I was saying that I was speaking to one of the people who's very much involved as part of the family with this title, with The New Yorker, and he was saying that this is really one of the few titles in their entire stable that works for them on a tablet, and many other magazines, fashion and interiors related. They're just not working, and I'm wondering what your view is that, or does it even surprise you, Andy, when you hear that, based on the fact that here's something you want to read, and do you really, if you've buying Architectural Digest, Spanish, Russian, German edition. You know, do you really want to look at it on a screen which is smaller than what you'd get, to look at those pages of that great house on Lake Como?
I think it depends. And there are many titles that are successful on tablet. For me personally, I read on the phone. And so the tablet, I don't read much on the tablet. I look a lot on the tablet. Mm. I think the browsing experience on the tablet is amazing. And so I'm very interested, for example, in HTML5 as a way of consuming your well-presented content. I like looking at websites on it. But different, some magazines have had completely unexpected success on the tablet. I mean, and although
name three.
Nuts magazine. Nuts magazine has
For people who don't know Nuts.
Nuts is a lads magazine, okay. and you find it on the newsstand, mm-hmm. Invariably featuring a very, very scantily clad young lady, you know, offering all sorts of delights inside. The nipple count in print is very high. Mm. Now, Apple will not allow you to put that content in the Apple Store, and so the Nuts editorial team have had to all the shoots.
Can you have
Nuts
in the Apple Store?
Yeah, they have Nuts in the Apple Store, yeah.
They do?
Oh, they do.
But no nipples?
No nipples. They've all been covered up. Right. Now, you may well think that this actually degrades the product or tones it down. You think, well, why the hell should I buy that? But what happened over Christmas is a whole lot of young guys all got tablets for Christmas and stuff. And what Nuts has seen is a huge uptick in single copy sales on the tablet of the girls completely covered up, because it's kind of okay. It's fun. It's a fast, funny fix of entertainment for men. This is how this thing was
okay,
originally
designed. Title number two.
10,000 copies a week they're doing. Mm. Single issue. So I think that's good. Wired is always going to be good because, you know, digital guys kind of like that thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's going to be good for them. Titles like Amateur Photographer, titles which have a real international appeal, very dense, they're very nerdy. You can buy this thing now all over the world. And okay, it's a PDF page turner. There's no bells, there's no whistles really. Mm. But the fact is, if you are that obsessive about that kind of content and you live in, you know, Johannesburg, then you can buy it straight away.
Right. But all of that, I could probably corral most of those people, you know, into sort of the same pen, because they're interested in sort of gadgets and whatnot. And so it makes sense. Well, I'm wondering, I haven't really, you know, scanned the masthead, but, you know, do you have a digital team of two or three working on printed pages, or is printed pages just that?
Yeah, exactly that. It's embracing print for what it is. The website presence is none. That's a lie. We have a one-page website that says what it is, what the content is in that issue, where you can get it.
Yeah.
And it's for
can,
that
can
reason.
Can you purchase from you as well?
You can purchase through. So we've just launched an online shop as well that's stocking a few other kind of bespoke things that we've collaborated with people. But it is that thing. The big issue we had when we did the It's Nice That magazine was people weren't sure what was in the magazine and what was online.
Mm.
And we get asked time and time again, what's your app? Where's your app? And our app is our website on a tablet. At the moment, more people are on Safari, kind of going through web content, or on Twitter, Facebook, getting shared links.
Mm.
And at the moment, and presumably the tablet editions exist so that sales can sell ad space. And potentially it's an opportunity to read longer form content and get more kind of content in. Mm. But I think if you can design something suitably for a web page, you can build that audience. And again, I can't remember exactly how you phrased it earlier, but digital is for growth and kind of print is for profit. And maybe I'm yet to be convinced that someone's doing this really, really fantastically well. And I think when that happens...
Yeah, when you find them, please send them our way as well. I'd love to interview them.
But I think when that happens, you'll then see that surge of people go, got it. This is how we're doing tablet editions. And then everyone will do it and they'll migrate, and that'll just be a natural process at the moment. And there's still a part of us that sort of looks at it and says, maybe we should be trying to work out how this works and what we can do. But at the moment, our team is not big enough to take those challenges on.
Mm. Gentlemen, should we do what this program says on the package and maybe review some magazines? You've got Esquire's Big Black Book. We've talked about The New Yorker. Here's another magazine which was in its prime, probably the middle of the last century. But they've gone through an interesting reinvention. Why did you bring in Esquire's Big Black Book?
I brought it in because from what I can work out, this stands alone from the monthly. So whereas the monthly, you'll still get that glossy cover with a celebrity and the kind of, I can't remember what the masthead says this time, but it's like 50 ways to do something. And actually, the Big Black Book is a nice kind of uncoated, foiled kind of typographic cover. And actually, the design sensibility is kind of, I don't know, there's something about it that makes me want to read the content. Whereas actually, maybe the design, and I'll be honest, I don't think I'm an Esquire reader. I don't think it's being targeted at me. But I really engage with this. I really kind of, I like the design of it. I like the photography that they've commissioned. And it's, they've just got nice small things. So they've got like a 18-page kind of tip-in. There's a spot colour that runs throughout it that we were discussing before, kind of makes quite a big difference. But it's a beautiful thing, which maybe I wasn't expecting from Esquire.
Right. And did you already, this was already sitting on your stack. It wasn't because you'd been booked to come on this programme?
I'll be totally honest. This was one that we actually got sent through to us.
Oh, did you? Okay.
So, but
you know, again, if you could sort of stand back from it, would you have gone and picked it up?
Yeah, I think so. Definitely. Okay. Yeah.
Your views, because, you know, you come from a company which has, has a business with men's magazines.
I like this when Will showed it to me. I really did. I mean, I don't have very strong feelings about the regular Esquire. I don't look at it. I don't see why I need to. But I think this is well done and well presented. I do think that the fifth colour through the web makes a huge difference. And, you know, colour is so important in the way in which magazines are designed. And when you see tiny amounts of very bright fluoro pink, you know, detailing out this proposition on good quality stock with some nice photography and some coherent typography, I think, actually, this looks smart, really smart. Nice.
I see another staple title in your stack over there, and you've got What's on TV. What's on TV and TV Pick as well. I think most people listening who don't know those titles hopefully can figure out what they're about. why did you want to talk about them?
What's on TV is a publishing phenomenon. The whole TV listings market is extraordinary. It's worth millions. This is a market...
Still worth millions.
Oh, still worth millions. What's on TV is not the market leader, but this has an ABC of over a million copies a week. Its Christmas double is the largest single newsstand...
Who publishes it?
IPC.
Okay.
The largest single newsstand sale of any title in the world. Sells about 2.5 million copies on the newsstand at Christmas for around about 82p. But the reason I brought it in is because I'm not a regular reader of What's on TV, but in terms of professional respect... This is the title that gets it for me. And it is interesting to see what has happened with the arrival of Desmond's new title here.
And so TV Pick is something new?
Yes, this is brand new.
Okay.
Yeah, and Richard Desmond has launched this. He's the publisher of the Express newspapers and everything else. And he's looked at the size of the pot here and thinks, I'll have some of that.
Right.
This is one of the most price-sensitive markets in the world. A penny, one way or another, makes a true difference to the sale. It's also one of the most pure editorial...
There's a bit of stapling for you, Will.
It's one of the most pure editorial propositions in the world, because you can only put in the magazine What's on TV that week.
Right.
And a certain amount of the magazine has to be devoted to listings. It's like pure math. And so therefore, the differences, the small differences in design and execution make real impact on the sale.
And here is a title as well that, you know, everyone would say, oh, well, you know, everyone's got a tablet at home, so they can just go and look at the listings grid at home. Why would you need a magazine like this?
Exactly. But here's the news. You know, What's on TV is 52p, and IPC have kept the price on it, and it's still selling 1,100,000 copies a week. This thing here, which is truly awful by comparison. I mean, you can see it's got exactly the same content, but look at the difference in here.
Right.
These, I mean, okay, we're on the radio, right? So you cannot see how wretched this thing is. But let me tell you that red on yellow, this is a shocking colourway. That's a cheap colourway. Whereas white out of red, that's a premium colourway. You know, this thing's here, got good blue in the back plate. I mean, these people really know what they're doing. The way in which they cut the lines, the way in which they tell the stories, these are soap stories, but the level of craft here... World class.
The common thing there is obviously the amount of people that have TVs and probably don't have tablets are actually the people who are buying this.
Yeah. If you don't have that much money, and many people in this country do not have that much money, you spend a hell of a lot of time watching TV. But the fact that these people are still prepared to pay 52p for this product, which you can find TV listings, you know, obviously online.
And in this market, you know, when so many markets are subscription markets, this is something you trot down to the newsstand to buy that, correct?
Yeah. This is
not dropping through your letterbox.
No. These are people going into the supermarket and picking this out. This is the most brutal fight on the newsstand.
Do we know how Mr. Desmond's faring so far?
Well, I think this is doing around about 300,000 at 20p, but he's giving all the money at the moment to the retailers as well. So,
right.
So basically he's catching a cold here big time, whereas these people are keeping their margin, they're keeping their price, and they're going to kill these people. I have respect for that.
Me too. I see that, you know, Will is sort of nodding because he's learned lots of you know, publishing tips. There were so many other things that we wanted to get through today, and maybe another time. I can see you've got Vice sitting over there, Will, and an ID under it, and interesting story behind all of that, which we need to come back to. There's also Harper's Bazaar. We've got Elle. There's a complete buffet here today, but we're going to have to leave it there. And I just had a weather update. The sun is still out. I've heard a few puffy clouds over the Thames, which means we should try to embrace this weather while we can in London. Andy Cowles, very good to see you. And good luck. We want to hear what happens in the next venture as well. And maybe we can talk about everything happening in the world of publishing, what happens with IPC. And Will Hudson, Printed Pages, absolutely brilliant. Congratulations on that. And of course, people can go to the back pages, and also great that you've also got the ability to order online as well. Our producer today was Adrian Craddock, and Claire Urban was the woman behind the controls on the far side of the glass. If you have any comments or queries, then drop us a note to info@monocle.com. And of course, you can always listen again via our website or, of course, the very, very magical iTunes. News is coming up in about 1 minute and 10 seconds time. And of course, at midday, the review is here. But for now, for me, Tyler Brulé, have a very good afternoon. Goodbye.